Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting for the sanctuary from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, now known as the Stockbridge Muncie community. I'm Kaylin McPherson.
And I'm Gabe Cruz Allen. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin by hearing about this year's 23rd Kateri Peace Conference from John Amidon. Then Dr. Lydia Harris joins us for this week's plastic PSA. Later on, we ask Mark Dunlea if the USA has learned any lessons in the 20 years since 9/11. After that, we get some history perspective on influences and developments on the Friends of Chamber Music. And finally, vegan food festival Veg Out is coming back to the Capital Region. The organizers join us to tell us more. But first, here are the headlines.
The Times Union reports that the parents of adults affected with conditions such as severe autism say they are being forced by a state agency to choose between sending their children to fenced-in institutional facilities in the far reaches of the Adirondacks that also houses criminals, or face the prospect of losing funding for their long-term care. Lawmakers are asking Governor Hochul to change this policy, contending it may violate a 1999 U.S. Supreme Court decision that entitles disabled persons to receive care in the least restrictive and most integrated setting.
Colony is in the top 15 cities and towns in New York for the most housing units added in the last decade.
The Daily Gazette reports that two areas, assembly members and Angelo Santa Barbara and Phil Steck, have issued a statement saying we strongly oppose putting state funding towards a charter school in the city of Schenectady. They noted that Schenectady has the most diverse school board in the history of the city and said that they had confidence that the state board will ensure a fair and equitable education for all students. The statement questioned whether the charter school improves educational outcome while diverting resources from tried and true public schools.
Schenectady Mayor Gary McCarthy on Thursday will hold a meeting with the Stockade Neighborhood Association, the first of a series of meetings he'll be holding with neighborhood associations regarding the city's use of $52.9 million in federal coronavirus relief funds. Local governments can use the money to support public health expenditures, address negative economic impacts caused by the public health emergency, replace lost public sector revenue, provide premium pay for essential workers, and invest in water, sewer, and broadband infrastructure.
New York Senator Charles Schumer and Christian Gillibrand pushed Sunday for a $33 million in federal funding to upgrade weather warning systems across the state and in the country in response to deadly flooding rains dumped by the remnants of Hurricane Ida.
The Times Union reports that a federal judge in Utica has overturned a civil jury verdict that in May cleared four Troy police officers of using excessive force on a 50-year-old man outside a Congress Street bar, citing improper remarks by a defense attorney primarily related to different videos of the incident. A new trial will take place. And that's it for the headlines.
For those just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. You like what you hear? Find these stories and more at the Hudson Mohawk Magazine .org/stories. I recommend checking it out.
To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org or email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390.
The 23rd annual Kateri Peace Conference, taking place virtually on Saturday, September 18th, is focusing on climate and militarism. John Amadon discussed why it is a code red planet, including the threat of nuclear weapons, with Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're talking with John Amadon, and he, is, along with Marina Mann, is the organizers of the 23rd annual Qatari Peace Conference this year, going virtual. So John, understand the issue or theme this year is militarism and climate change. Why don't you give us a brief introduction as to, you know, what is the Qatari Peace Conference and why, you know, Code Red Planet this year?
Yeah, the why Code Red Planet this year is because we are truly in a planetary crisis. The climate is failing us in because of our own behavior, and we need to confront militarism and stop it and take all of the approximately $1 trillion spent each year on climate restoration. And we need to curtail the use of greenhouse gases. The military is emitting 59 million metric tons a year or more. So it's a huge problem. The military is polluting the environment in so many different ways. And if we don't confront it, we don't have a meaningful program. The Qatari Peace Conference has been working to restrict and oppose militarism and end war for 23, 24 years now. Actually, we started in 1998. And then we were focused on closing the School of the Americas. But we've changed over the years, and we really need for everyone to look closely at what they can do to help the climate by positive things like planting trees, by negative thing, or not negative, but confrontational, I should say, good confrontations with the government prodding people like Paul Tonko to do something useful. And Mark, I know you've been instrumental in that, and thank you.
You know, the doomsday clock has moved closer to midnight, and they moved it closer not only because of nuclear weapons, but also because of climate change. But I do see you are having at least one workshop at the conference about nuclear weapons. What's the present focus on that?
Well, I mean, as we move into more extreme conditions with the climate, I mean, there are going to be huge water shortages in some places. There already are. And for example, in India and China, two of the most populous nations in the world, the two, in fact, they are having water shortages. They border each other. They all have nuclear weapons, as does Pakistan. So if push comes to shove, that could be very tense, and it could lead actually to a nuclear war, God forbid, but that's the reality. So we need to understand that climate collapse, climate change is worsening the possibilities for war of different types, and nuclear war is certainly one of them, and one we need to avoid at all costs.
Now, if people want to participate, attend in this year's conference, you know, how do they do that?
The best way, the easiest way for the radio listeners is to Google Code Red Planet and Qatari, K-A-T-E-R-I. Just Google those two words and it'll bring you a link to an address to go to where you can register for the conference. And the conference is free. You do need to register. It's being hosted by World Beyond War. And they're hosting our Zoom platform. It is September 18th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m.
And who are some of the presenters this year?
Well, you mentioned nuclear weapons, and we have Arthur Hennessy, and she is one of the Kings Bay Plowshare activists. She is just out of prison for a 10-month sentence for protesting the Trident submarine base and Trident submarine and the missiles down in Georgia. She is also one of the granddaughters of Dorothy Day, and just a really wonderful person who's done such good work over the years. We have Ricky Closing. He's an artist, community activist, and a war resister. He was in the 82nd Airborne Division and worked as an interrogator. And after witnessing the abuses in Iraq, he went AWOL after having a crisis of conscience. Anyway, it resulted in a court-martial and a 3-month military sentence. And so he is, again, somebody who has gone to prison to assert and uphold his conscience and not kill innocent people. Anyway, he became a peace activist, and he is working now for the city of Tacoma as a development specialist, and he thrives on building community and connecting people to nature. We also have Lindsay Koshirk, sorry for butchering this name, Koshgarian. She's the National Priorities Project Director, and she's been on NPR and BBC and CNN and The Nation, U.S. News, World Report, and others, and she'll be addressing the intersection of military and domestic and federal spending and looking at, you know, really good ways of using our resources and how the military isn't and creating climate havoc. We have Cynthia Lazarus, and she is the founder of Nuclear Wake Up Call, and she is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, author of Dawn of the New Armageddon. I mean, all of these people have such wonderful resumes. They're all on our website with complete information. Cherry Robin will be singing. She is from the Capital District. Robin Cossack Jazz and Blues is her latest band. She's done 3 albums and a tremendous voice, a tremendous Carol Sargent.
Yeah, you were cutting out there, unfortunately. See, you know, this is the 23rd annual Qatari Peace Conference. You know, we just passed both the 20th anniversary of September 11th, which, you know, kicked off or escalated the war on terror. And we also just deserved the United States at least pulling out its military troops from Afghanistan after 20 years. You know, what type of reflections, if any, will the conference make about, you know, those two particular milestones?
We probably won't address those unless they come up in questions. We are really focused on the climate collapse, and the role militarism is playing in this planetary concern. And I mean, we are in critical state. If the Atlantic currents shut down, and nobody knows when that will happen, you know, all bets are off. If methane gas release happens in a major way, and it's already happening in smaller quantities, again, all bets are off. And when the polar ice caps melt, and they're doing that very rapidly, the oceans will rise at least 6 to 8 feet. So we will be focused on climate change and the role militarism is playing, and what we can do about it to stop it, and how we can address our government, what we can do as individuals. We need to wake up and really be aware that we are in a crisis.
So we've been talking with John Amanon, the Qatari 23rd Qatari Peace Conference on Saturday, September 18th, Code Red Planet, Militarism and Climate Change. John, any final words?
Just that it's free. There are excellent speakers. Greta Zorro from World Beyond War is also speaking. And tune in. We prefer to do it in person because we build more community that way, but conditions are such that we can't. But Code Red Planet, Qatari are the words to Google, and you'll find an easy way to register, and it's an excellent conference. So please do join us.
Thank you, John Amadon. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
The 23rd annual Kateri Peace Conference will be taking place virtually on Saturday, September 18th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. If you are interested in attending this event, go to our website at mediasanctuary.org.
Dr. Lyda Harris is a marine biologist and microplastics researcher based in Seattle. She is a postdoctoral microplastic fellow at the Seattle Aquarium. She recently gave a talk on the growing field of marine microplastic pollution and her work.
My name is Lyda Harris. I recently finished my PhD at University of Washington in marine microplastics. And right now I am a postdoctoral microplastic fellow at the Seattle Aquarium, which is really neat because when I started this journey 6 years ago, there were no jobs for me. This wasn't a field that people invested in. It wasn't a field that people cared about. So I think I really lucked out. And so a lot of what I do focuses on pollution in the local Salish Sea. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with where the Salish Sea is, it is the body of water just outside of Tacoma, Olympia, and Seattle, Washington. It also borders Victoria and Vancouver, Canada, also known as the Puget Sound. So a lot of what I do works with organisms. So looking at organism physiology, looking at the ecosystem level impacts, contamination on a spatial and a temporal scale, and then how research contributes to policies. So what is microplastics? Microplastic isn't necessarily the plastic that we see every day. It is the tiny, tiny plastic particles. So plastic that's less than 5 millimeters in size. So that's the size of the like very end of your fingernail or a sesame seed. What do those look like? So I study a lot of these types of particles and most of my time is spent looking at a microscope. And so underneath a microscope, these types of plastics can take a lot of different shapes and colors. And so the four different types of shapes that we're seeing are fiber, film, fragment, and sphere. And so one question is potentially, where are these coming from? And you might look at this and say, oh, those look a lot different than what I expected microplastics to look like. Or, oh, those look a lot different than, you know, this like plastic SodaStream bottle that I have next to me. And it's because they constantly are breaking down into smaller and smaller pieces. And so they might start out as larger things. And so if we think about what microplastic pollution is, what it is and where it comes from, as I mentioned, I live in the Pacific Northwest. So I love everything Pacific Northwest, including hiking mountains and kayaking in the waters and the environment, everything. That's the entirety of me. But my jacket is now made out of plastic. My pants are made out of plastic. My super sturdy mountaineering boots are made out of plastic. We're finding plastic in our table salt. We're finding it in our water. We're finding it in our salt water, just full of jokes today. I play Frisbee. I am constantly just chasing plastic my entire day. And we're even finding it in the beer that we're drinking. So it is very ubiquitous in our system. We're finding it literally every place that we're looking. Everything that we're consuming today ends up making microplastics in the future. As the field of marine microplastics grow, it is doubling every 1.3 years, which is wild. And so just think about 1.3 years ago, that's less than the pandemic. We have double the number of papers today than we did in March of 2020. We know twice as many things. And one of those key driving factors are organisms. And so when we think about the ocean, there's lots of little things that live in the ocean. There's mussels, which I'm going to be talking about a lot. There's things like salmon and larvae of fish and zooplankton and different algae, but there's also microplastics floating around in that algae. And so there's a lot of different food levels or levels of, they're called trophic levels. So levels of consumption that are potentially affected. And these things don't exist in a vacuum. They exist really connected to one another. And so if perhaps the mussel is affected, that has a potentially cascading effect on a fish or on things that live into the sediment and then subsequently into zooplankton, copepods, and larval fishes as well. And so when we're talking about all of these things, it's not just, oh, the salmon, oh, the orcas, oh, the cute little sea otters. We're not talking about just those things, but perhaps that's what we're studying. We're talking about the system as a whole. And so when you just think about like a healthy water, healthy body of water, you expect that there's going to be algae in it. Algae are autotrophs, so they're producing all of their own energy. They're producing everything that they need to survive. And a mussel comes along, which is called a heterotroph, meaning that it needs to eat something else. And so it eats the algae, which is great. Mussels love algae. Mussels, when you're farming them or they're living in the wild, they live in really dense populations. And so if you've never seen a mussel farm, they're grown in, at least on the West Coast, they're grown in lines underwater that extend from like the surface down to probably 30 feet underwater, or they're on the coastal habitats and they're in these really, really dense populations. And so when you look at these pictures, it's not just mussels that are growing there. There's barnacles in here, there's algae in here, there's probably some sea stars in there, there's a jellyfish right here. There's all sorts of things that rely on these communities. So mussels are really, really good at examining, so we can see the potential effects on other organisms as well as on the water, because in these big communities, they're constantly filtering the water. And so perhaps you've heard of the Chesapeake Bay and the oysters that live in the Chesapeake Bay. I think that's probably the most famous example, is that the oysters are turning over and cleaning the water in the Chesapeake Bay. Like, once they're able to filter all of the water, like once a day, a crazy amount. Mussels do the same thing. And so the more mussels you have, potentially the more cleaner the water is. And so going back to our diagram, we can study how microplastic affects mussels, and then down the line, what the effects may or may not be. And so when we think about microplastics, great, we have microplastics in the water column, microplastics in the water, they're everywhere. If mussels are feeding on microplastics, if they're present in the water, they're going to be feeding on microplastics. We've been able to demonstrate that the clearance rate or the filtration rate of these mussels decreases. So they're not able to filter as much water in a given amount of time as they would in non-polluted water. Great. So the takeaway from that is, okay, so our water might not be as clean. The second takeaway is mussels have microplastics in them, like everything else. But that doesn't really send any sort of message unless you're a shellfish grower or really concerned about water quality. But as these mussels are ingesting the microplastics and clearing water at a slower rate, they're also producing poop, and that poop sinks down. But when it has microplastics in it, microplastics tend to be lighter than water. And so it decreases the sinking rate. So it actually makes them more buoyant, so they stay in the water column longer. Conversely, it increases resuspension. So sinking rate is the propensity for something to go down. Resuspension is something to go up. And so it just means these two things together, these poop particles with microplastics in them, now just spend more time in the water column where things like copepods or larval fish or salmon, where they're trying to get their nutrients and their food. And if I ever show you a picture of some mussel poop, you'll realize it looks a lot like a lot of things that these organisms are eating. Looks just like some algae, or it looks just like some copepods. And so they're going along similar to the sea turtle eating plastic bags when it thinks it's jellyfish, and just consuming it. So if we go one step further, we're finding that although mussels do have microplastics in them pretty unanimously across the world, you know, we found microplastics in mussels in the West Coast, in the East Coast, in Europe, in China, in Australia, everywhere. There's relatively low amounts of concentrations and like contaminations. And so These muscles are really good at filtering out what they want and what they don't want. And so a lot of these particles may end up back into the environment rather than sequestered within the muscle itself. So taking all of those pieces together, we have a decreased clearance rate. So they're cleaning the water less efficiently. Their poop is remaining in the water column and they're not very contaminated. So that's good news on the shellfish front if you're eating shellfish. Bad news if you're pretty much any other organism, because you're probably going to come along and eat it and your water probably isn't as clean as it once was. But the upshot of this, have to end on like a positive note maybe, is that the national publications and policies are increasing. So the quantity that countries are publishing on marine microplastic and passing national plastic bans is increasing substantially.
That was marine biologist Dr. Lyda Harris speaking with Alexis Goldsmith for this week's Plastic PSA. For those just tuning in, I'm Gabe Cruz-Allen.
And I'm Kellen McPherson. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOC Low Power 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS Low Power 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA Low Power 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA Low Power 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, now known as the Stockbridge Muncie community.
We continue our interview with Mark Dunlea, a longtime peace activist and writer of the op-ed, The Unlearned Lessons of 9/11, 20 Years Out. Mark spoke with Sina Basilahicki about what he saw happening in the Capital Region and if we've learned any lessons in the 20 years since.
So after September 11th, there was an increase in anti-Arab and anti-Muslim, or at least what was perceived to be anti-Muslim, because many Sikh individuals were the victims of terrorist attacks. Targeting certain groups is a common reaction when people need an outlet for rage and anger. How did this play out in the Capital Region? What did you see happening here?
Well, I think we were fortunate in the Capital District in that generally the sort of anti-Muslim, anti-Arabic influence that we saw in the rest of the country was far less prevalent here in the United States. And I will say, you know, one of the big victims of war is always the truth. And, you know, the 9/11 Commission was largely an exercise to sort of protect the reputations of the intelligence industry, the FBI, the CIA, national security, you know, for failing to adequately, you know, protect the United States against this. And there's a lot of evidence that, you know, there were a lot of warning signals, red flags, even warnings from other allied countries that a terrorist attack, you know, was about to occur or possibly could occur. And our intelligence community, you know, failed to take, you know, action on that. And at best was criminal negligence. But in the Capital District, you know, sort of the big issue was about, I think about 3 years later, after 9/11, you know, suddenly we hear Governor Pataki and the Albany Police and the FBI, you know, holding a press conference to announce a major breakup of a terrorist ring here in the Capital District. And within hours, I actually held a press conference in front of the mosque on Central Avenue. We said, this is nonsense. There's no allegation that actually there's any terrorist activity took place, no allegation about missiles or actually existed. This was a complete, you know, sting operation against a pizza store owner in downtown Albany and his imam who came along in order to witness a transaction, which is sort of the practice apparently and Muslims when you're, you know, sort of lending money. And even the mainstream media, the Times Union, Carl Strzok, particularly at the Daily Gazette, immediately said, this is bogus. This is oversold. These people really appear innocent in a big trial. They were found innocent of 20 of the 30 charges. You know, most of us viewed it as the jury basically agreeing these people, you know, really weren't, certainly were not terrorists, and certainly really, you know, maybe they didn't cross the T's and dot the I's, but was not a major, you know, terrorist activities. And even though they were found innocent on most of the charges, they ended up with, you know, sort of 15 years in prison. And then the FBI informant in this particular case, who was selling illegal security documents, particularly licenses, ends up being the owner of the limousine that, you know, killed the 20 people in Schoharie, and his son running the company ends up with no jail time, you know, for killing 20 people. But the leader, you know, of the mosque, you know, on Central Avenue where the imam was sent away, still said he always felt, and their community always felt a lot of support here in the Capital District, that civic leaders, political leaders, community groups went out of the way to say, you know, you cannot blame all Muslims for the individual acts of a few individuals. And there were a lot of groups, both in Albany and particularly in Bethlehem, that really rallied to show support for the Muslim community, and also a lot of religious leaders, interfaith leaders. And so that was, you know, much better here in the Capital District, the biggest exception being the state capitol, where you had Governor Pataki and the state legislators. But the political figures in the Capital District did not engage in that, you know, anti-Muslim rhetoric, fortunately.
Before I let you go, have we learned any lessons from the tragedy of September 11th?
You know, I have not heard many lessons being repeated as we get up, you know, to the 20th anniversary. You know, there still really has not been a call, you know, that it's time to end the war on terror. You know, there's not been a, you know, any political switch from the major parties that, you know, we should be trying to, you know, increase our humanitarian, you know, relationships. We never dealt with the fact, you know, we're just 20 years out. Once again, you know, Afghanistan was the graveyard of empires. You know, we left in disgrace. 170,000 Afghans have died because of the invasion, and, you know, several thousand American, you know, soldiers also died. We never addressed the fact, why is Afghanistan in this situation? And Afghanistan is certainly a complicated country, but the reality is that starting under President Carter, you know, the United States invested money and military support to overthrow the government of Afghanistan because they, one, viewed it as being too aligned with the Soviet Union, who was their northern neighbor. But they consciously thought if they could create, you know, a civil collapse, government collapse in Afghanistan by financing these warlords, that it would force the Soviet Union to invade and basically drag him into their own version of Vietnam. And that occurred, you know, their thing collapsed. The Taliban was something that probably the CIA, along with Pakistan, helped put into power to try to stabilize the situation. The Taliban invited in al-Qaeda partly to provide them with security against the warlords, and then allegedly, you know, it was these al-Qaeda training camps that launched the attacks on 9/11. And the CIA itself, which basically had the same thing 20 years previously when it overthrew the government, elected government of Iran, you know, calls this blowback. You know, that when you do, you know, these underhanded things to overthrow governments, it tends to come back in your face with, you know, violence and, you know, terror attacks 15, 20 years later. And we just seem to sort of keep repeating this. And the reality is that we have escalated our war, Cold War with Russia. We particularly started under Obama, really escalated the tensions with China. Certainly, we continue to have a lot of tensions under all presidents, particularly Trump, with Iran. And we continue to meddle into the operations of governments in South America. You know, still the Monroe Doctrine, you know, exist. And we think it's perfectly fine for us to interfere with Venezuela or Bolivia or Guatemala, Honduras, Haiti, or Cuba. And so we keep on repeating the same mistakes. We've lost a lot of credibility on the world stage. Certainly the chaotic nature of Biden's retreat, which I supported, actually, trying to pull the troops out of Afghanistan, but not handled particularly well. But, you know, they said, oh, my God, I thought we were getting better leadership from America after Trump. And now Biden shows not to be able to handle, you know, this type of situation. I think American prestige is at its lowest level ever. Polls show that the rest of the planet views the United States as the greatest threat to democracy in their own country, and that we continue to, you know, export arms to militias all across the planet, either directly or in the case of Afghanistan. We give them to allies who then either turn them over on the black market or they get stolen and end up funding the militias in Africa and the Middle East and, you know, South America. We're the arms merchant of the planet. We have a terrible democracy. And because we send so much money on the military, we don't meet basic needs like housing and health care and education. It's incredible we spend more money on our healthcare system compared to pretty much any other industrial nation in the world, often twice as much. And yet we're consistently ranked among not even in the top 30 in the quality of our healthcare system. And that's all directly attributed to the fact that we spend so much of our resources on the military. And 20 years later, nothing has changed, unfortunately.
You can hear the full conversation between Sina Basila-Hickey and Mark Dunley at our website at mediasanctuary.org.
In this, their 73rd year, the Friends of Chamber Music Troy, Jennifer Larson speaks about the history, the influence of immigration on chamber music, the development of the genre in the Americas, and this season's return to live performances. The Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Andrea Cunliffe brings us this interview.
This is Andrea Cunliffe from Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm speaking with Jennifer Larson of the Friends of the Chamber Music. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Jennifer.
Thank you.
What is the Friends of the Chamber Music?
Yeah, I'll start with what Friends of Chamber Music is. We're in our 73rd season. So there was a time when the first really big string quartet in Europe managed to come to the U.S. And they were called the Budapest String Quartet. And they sort of spawned this excitement about this kind of ensemble as they traveled around the U.S. And as a result, they inspired the Guarneri Quartet, the Juilliard Quartet, the Cleveland. And during that time, there was also quite a lot of new music being composed on this side of the Atlantic. And they called themselves the ultra modernists. They were doing things that would get the audience would throw tomatoes at them. You know, they were really, really out there. And that one of them happened to be at Emma Willard School. She worked on the New Music Quarterly with two of the ultra modernists, Henry Cowell, and the other one was Ruth Crawford Seeger, the mother of Pete Seeger. And so I had never met her. She was long gone by the time I got there, but she was certainly a very experimental and open sort of person. And she founded Friends of Chamber Music at Emma Willard School. She was chair of their music department. It was probably toward the end of her career. She may have retired and then taken that job. I don't know the details on that. So that's how it started. There were just some people who were enthusiastic about chamber music during the time. And 1949 was the year. Certain new immigrants from Europe, this chamber music was important to them. It was something they brought with them. And and were enthusiastic about it. It made it feel like it was home for them.
So how did that immigration affect the music? And you're talking mostly classical music.
Mostly classical music. It's a little difficult to say, but amongst the immigrants was someone named Ivan Galamian, who was Armenian, and he founded really the American style of violin playing that came out of Juilliard. And all the players in the U.S. are trained in the Galamian technique now. So that's one example. One of the immigrants became important at Johns Hopkins and really was the founder of their music program. And Walden Pond, which is the composition summer festival that came out of there. So really, all over the United States, people of Armenian and Jewish backgrounds coming to the United States either before World War II or after World War II really greatly influenced this art form. But we also had our own experimental side. You know, Charles Ives is American. Henry Cowell, those ultra-modernists really came out of UC Berkeley and the West Coast. So it wasn't purely European of some sort of melding of the two. And probably, you know, there's an American style of playing that came from Galamian, but it's not the way they play in Europe so much, where the sound is big and full. And in Europe, there's a lot more sort of softer playing. So we have string quartets here who really fill a room with their sound because they just have they have the chops. And so yes, there was an immigration that influenced it. And then cut to now, we have a member of our board who is an immigrant from Syria.
Chamber music. Yeah. Can you define what chamber music is, how it differs from other music?
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to start with something less boring.
Okay.
It's sort of a description. It's a living music with active, diverse composers, young players playing it. It's a vibrant scene that you wouldn't know about just, you know, if you were to see an average audience in Troy, you wouldn't necessarily know that it is such a vibrant scene in other places. So it's usually an ensemble that is between 2 and 12 members. The string quartet is the most commonly performed chamber ensemble. And it could be winds, could be strings, generally acoustic. Sometimes you add a piano. Sometimes you add a vocalist or a percussionist. There are chamber percussionists. There are entire chamber percussion ensembles, which are quite interesting. And then there's some weird groups, like a Perrault ensemble is one that a lot of living composers and those avant-garde composers we mentioned earlier, it was developed by Schoenberg. And it's a really strange array of instruments that are often used now. So it's a violin, a viola. Often the violinist also plays viola, a cello, and a vocalist who does something called sprechstimme, which is kind of a speaking, squealing kind of thing.
sort of rap in a classical way.
Yeah, it's a special vocal technique that came out of that period. And then a piano, so that's one particular, and a flute. There's always a flute.
Performance in context. Is this something you personally developed?
Started it last year. The first year I was here, I added pre-concert talks, like live talks before the, and I was really careful to choose groups that incorporated talking into their presentation. And the audience really appreciates that. And they're learning also, you know. And then they play the concert and everyone gets what they were talking about in context, right? And I thought that was pretty successful because people would remarked about it, would approach me and tell me how much they enjoyed it. But I really had in the back of my mind that I wanted to expand these in one way or another. So last year when we went virtual, and I was thinking, well, if we only have six programs and they're all virtual, and we want to get our audience to connect with each other like they would in a normal year, to connect with the musicians in a way that they wouldn't be able to connect just by viewing an online concert. But it had been something I wanted to do for a long time. I think that for people to enjoy being part of an audience, sometimes for them to understand something about the musicians' lives, the equipment they're playing is important. And I also think it's important for all of us to think about the significance of the artist in the community. And so I wanted to explore those ideas. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'll be asking him some kind of nuts and bolts things that people might want to know about. What is it like to be in a string quartet? Which means that this is an exclusive ensemble. They sometimes play solo and other things elsewhere, but they practice together, travel together. They're like a single instrument, and their entire life is tied to these four people. And it's a very intense kind of situation. They have to come up with a group sound, and they have a sound that is readily identifiable, as you discovered. How many hours do you rehearse a day when you're not touring? You know, what's an average workday look like for a string quartet?
This has been Andrea Conlon speaking with Jennifer Lawson of the Friends of Chamber Music of Troy, New York. Friends of Chamber Music coming season includes November concert by the Dover Quartet, and then January 15th, a concert by the Metz Trio, winners of the 2019 Concert Artists Guild competition, and February, two soloists of international renown, a violinist and a cellist. They pair up in a concert featuring solo Bach and duo works by Ravel and Codet. The season finale will be on April 4th, and it'll feature the amazing Canary Quartet. The Canary will play a concert of arranged chamber works by Schumann, Mendelssohn, and Piazzolla, along with new compositions for this unusual ensemble of four saxophones. Connect with friendsofchambermusic.org.
This season's Friend of Chamber Music's Music Troy's concert are in September, November, January, and April. For full information, visit www.friendsofchambermusic.org.
For our last segment, we are joined by Amy Ellis, Community Outreach Coordinator at Honest Weight Food Co-op, Andrea Shea, the Operations Manager at Capital Region Vegan Network, and Sarah Shearer, Executive Director of the Capital Region Vegan Network. So can you start off by telling us, what is the Capital Region Vegan Network?
Sure, and thanks so much, Gabe, Kaylin, for having us here tonight. The Capital Region Vegan Network, we are the primary organization providing outreach, education, support, and advocacy for veganism in the Capital Region. And initially, our organization just started out as a group of friends 15 years ago in 2006, and they were traveling around the country and noticed some other cities had this VegFest event where people could learn more about vegetarianism and veganism. And they thought this would be something really great to bring to our area. So initially, we were just an organization that put on VegFests, and we eventually evolved into a 501c3 not-for-profit. We provide services throughout the year. We have our major events, which unfortunately didn't happen in 2020, but back in 2019, we had Veg Out and VegFest, which were our two big vegan festivals. And we also hold monthly events, monthly recipe club events, a Thanksgiving meal, family-friendly events like a Halloween event for kids. We spend time visiting with animals and volunteering. And we've recently hosted a few pop-ups with Honest Weight Food Co-op. So we're really doing a lot throughout the year, in addition to holding our Veg Out Food Festival, which is coming up this Sunday.
On September 19th, there'll be a Veg Out event. What is Veg Out?
So Veg Out is our food festival. As you said, it's coming up on Sunday, September 19th. It's going to be held 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. in Monument Square, which is located in downtown Troy, New York. We're going to have roughly 20 food vendors, a beer garden with nine pin and rare form serving local beer and cider. The Albany Symphony Orchestra is joining us for a 12:30 p.m. performance. And I'll let Amy discuss Honest Wheat Food Co-op's participation, but I'm really excited they're joining us. If attendees are wondering where to park, please note that both garage and street parking are free to park on weekends. With the Uncle Sam garage being closed, the closest garage to the festival will be the Fifth Ave parking garage, and it's about a 5-minute walk from there to Monument Square.
So what type of food will be at the festival? And also, is there any variety in vegan food?
Absolutely. We have definitely worked hard this year to create a menu of diverse vendors, so there's something for everyone. If you're looking for healthy options, there will be multiple vendors with wraps, hummus, falafel, fancy specialty salads, stews, and other dishes. And if you're looking for something a bit more with a party or festival feel, of course, there'll also be vegan versions of pizza, tacos, burritos, baked goods, pastries, chocolates, gelato, and ice cream sandwiches. There are some foods that people don't even realize aren't typically vegan. For example, caramel apples or caramel usually contains dairy. It's not an ingredient people can typically taste or even notice, but it keeps people who are vegan or dairy-free from enjoying a lot of those foods. So by removing dairy from something like caramel, it's so simple and it lets everyone enjoy. So if you are a vegan or a vegetarian, or you have a family member who is, you know, this is definitely an event for everyone. You know, come out, bring your friends, bring your family. There is absolutely something for everyone. And actually most of our vendors will also have gluten-free options as well.
What is the Honest Wheat Food Co-op's role in Veg Out?
So Honest Wheat Food Co-op is a sponsor of the event this year. Honest Wheat has had a long, you know, long-lasting relationship, partnership with the vegan, plant-based, vegetarian community for many years. So it only makes sense for us to be involved in an event like this. So Honest Wheat is going to showcase their bulk department. And we're also going to pick some specialty items to share with the community, some local, locally produced products that, you know, we've been selling up, that we sell at the store.
So how accessible would you say that vegan food is?
That's a good question. Do you mean in terms of how easy is it to find it in the area, or how easy is it to kind of make it and eat it at home, anything along those lines?
I was actually interested in more about like the pricing of vegan food.
Ah, okay, sure. I think it really can vary. So I hear sometimes people say, oh, I can never be vegan. That food is way too expensive. You know, all of these fancy cheeses and all these things, I can't afford that. And I think there is a way that you can go fancy schmancy vegan and, you know, buy all the replacement type products. And I could list some brands that I'd recommend if you want to go that direction. But then there's also a way where you can live on a budget and choose vegan choices like rice and beans or really just great fresh produce and, you know, cook that up into a nice vegan bowl with a delicious sauce on it. And that can be something that is tasty, is good for you. It's not only salads, but, you know, you can have interesting different flavors with spices. A lot of times when people are cooking non-vegan food, it's really the spices or the herbs that are adding flavor to those dishes. And so a lot of those same herbs and spices you can add into vegan food. And, you know, you can get it in bulk at Honest Wheat and that kind of thing at a pretty cheap price. For some of those rice and beans and spices. So there really is a way to do it that's reasonably cost a reasonable cost as well.
That's really good to know. Thank you.
What should non-vegans understand about being vegan?
You know, sometimes the people get caught up in the word vegan, but for me, when I think about it, it really just means that I don't think we should give unnecessary harm to animals. And I feel like in general, if you look past the term and, you know, past what you think is kind of the standard definition of who should or shouldn't be a vegan, if we can, I think a lot of people would say, hey, I don't really want to cause unnecessary harm to animals. I'd like to figure out a way to have my diet align with those values and to make those choices that really fit with what I really believe in. You know, personally, I grew up and I stopped eating meat when I was 13. And I think initially it was because I really just loved cats. And I think a lot of us have a cat or a dog who we really love and connect with. And I think it's making that leap to, oh, this cat or dog isn't really that different from the pig or the cow that I'm eating on my plate. And, you know, making that connection there, I think, is something that helps people think about it differently and thinking about how can we make choices. It's easy to make choices that don't hurt others. And it's really delicious. I love food. It's so important to me and to have good, tasty meals. And I feel like that's what I'm getting as a vegan.
Was there something you'd like to add there, Sarah? It looked like you wanted to jump in there.
Sure. Just to follow up on what Andrea was saying about, you know, really loving food. I would say, yeah, that's definitely a preconceived notion some people have about vegans is that we all live on salad and we're not really interested in foods. And I'll tell you, a lot of the vegans that I know personally, we travel for food quite frequently. We will go to other festivals hours away. We will try restaurants hours away, plan our weekends around these trips. So really, you know, again, a lot of the vegans that I know personally and myself included, we are really, really foodies. And, you know, if you ask us questions in general, just like Andrea was saying about spices or seasoning, which is really typically what makes a dish, you'd be surprised how much vegans can tell you about food in general.
So our last question is, where can listeners get more information?
Sure. So you can go to our website, www.capregionvegans.org. You can also follow us on social media. We are on Facebook. We're on Instagram. We're also on Meetup. And our email address and other ways to contact us are on the website as well. Please, if you have any questions, shoot us an email, message us on social media. We would love to hear from you. And if you have any ideas for upcoming events you would like to see.
We'd like to thank our guests for joining us, Amy Ellis, Community Outreach Coordinator at Honest Waste Food Co-op, Andrea Shea, Operations Manager at Capital Region Vegan Network, and Sarah Sheeter, Executive Director of the Capital Region Vegan Network. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Kalen McPherson.
And I'm Gabe Cruz Allen. And our engineer is Sina Basila Hickey.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. You can find all the stories from today's program on our website through Hudson Mohawk Magazine Podcast and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in. Stay safe and get outdoors.